Welcome to New Books and Film. I am your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I will be speaking with David Lurson, co-author of the book War on the Silver Screen, Shaping America's Perception of History. The book was published by Potomac Books in 2014. In the book, David and his co-author, Glenn Johnson, discuss a number of films that deal with 20th century conflicts. Beginning with World War I, the so-called War to End All Wars, through the present War on Terror, the authors review how each film dealt with the issues of the particular war, the people who fought the war, and the society affected by the war. I hope you enjoy my conversation with David Lurson. Welcome, David. How are you today?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
Very good. I'm glad you had a chance to talk to me. The book is very interesting, and bottom line is war has been a popular subject for film since the earliest days of motion pictures. So, and your book reviews a number of films arranged specifically by conflict. That's the order or the method you use to organize the book. But before we get into the book itself, can you give me your background? Have you written other material related to film as well?
Yes, my previous book was a biography of Ruben Mamoulian, a film director, very innovative film director from the 1930s and 40s. He did one of the first truly successful talking pictures called Applause. Successful because the movie actually moved around. The earliest talking pictures were very static because of the cumbersome technology. He figured ways around that. He directed the first full-length feature color film in Technicolor later on during the 1930s. So this was not the war movies book. War on the Silver Screen is not my first film book, but I am primarily a cultural historian by education. And whether I'm writing a biography of a filmmaker or a political figure, or delving into some other historical topic, or looking at films, as I did in this book, I'm always trying to understand the culture around the people and the events, trying to figure out what shaped the people, what shaped the movies, what shaped the books that people were reading, and then what influence this in turn had on the society around the people and books and films.
Okay. What made you decide that this was the subject you wanted to write about next? And what kind of research did you have to perform to decide which films to include?
Well, Glenn, my partner in this, conceived the idea of doing a book on how America remembers, its wars through the movies made about them. So I can't take credit for the idea. He came to me with the idea. We have written, co-written a couple of books in the past, including a biography of Elvis Presley. So he came up with the idea, and I began thinking about how to go about this. I don't remember if it was his thought or my thought that we should begin the book with World War I, because the creation of Hollywood, the beginnings of Hollywood, coincided with World War I. World War I was also the first war in which really technically proficient films were being made during the war about the war. The Spanish-American War, for example, there were actually a couple of really short so-called documentaries being made at the time on that war, but they were very primitive, and the circulation of them wasn't very wide, and nobody remembers them anyway. So World War I seemed to be a very good place to begin the project. From that point on, I chose the movies that we focused on in the book. I chose them because they were movies that I really enjoyed, for one thing. I didn't want to spend a great deal of time writing a book about movies I didn't like. But the more important factor than my own taste was whether these movies really do still resonate in our society today. Whether when we think about World War I or World War II or Vietnam, whether, you know, these movies actually, you know, help shape our imagination. And there are many fine movies, war movies, that were not included in the book because I don't think that people, by and large, remembered them very well.
was interesting that, especially with World War One, the first two movies that you covered in the book, All Quiet on the Western Front and Paths of Glory, were basically very, I don't want to use the word anti-war, but they certainly had their attitude towards war that we didn't necessarily always, we don't necessarily always see with war movies. And in fact, some of the other ones on your list are much different in tone, but it is so interesting that those first two, even though they're separated by a number of years, All Quiet on the Western Front came out in between the two wars, and clearly you could tell it covered the book very well. It acquitted itself very well in relation to the book. What was it about All Quiet on the Western Front in particular that you felt made for such a great first movie to discuss?
Well, it is the first World War One movie that still is part of the cultural DNA of nowadays. Even people who have never seen the movie somehow know about it. I mean, anybody who really cares about movies or about war, I guess, and they put it that way, has heard about All Quiet on the Western Front. Many people may have seen snippets of it in documentaries about historical filmmaking. And somehow the name is out there in people's minds. But also, I think it in many ways set the template for how future filmmakers like Stanley Kubrick with Paths of Glory, how do you depict something as horrifying as trench warfare on the Western Front? All Quiet set the standards for that. And to your point about both of these movies being anti-war, and a third movie in the World War One chapter, Gallipoli, can also be seen as being kind of an anti-war movie. Yeah, World War One is not a movie that many people could look back upon nostalgically. I mean, it was a extremely bloody conflict fought for reasons that had nothing to do really with great moral imperatives. It was a treaty system in Europe, political jockeying for power on the European continent. Many other countries around the world got dragged into the war for one reason or another. Casualties were heavy. The conditions of war were bad, not only for troops on the front line, but in Europe for the civilian population as well. So unlike World War II, where you can certainly see a right versus wrong, a forces of light versus forces of darkness, World War One was a very murky conflict from any kind of ethical standpoint, and a very most unpleasant conflict, very all-encompassing for the societies involved with it. And yeah, I think the war left a very bitter taste in the mouths of the participants and the memories of their descendants. And as a consequence, it's very difficult to imagine a pro-war World War One film being made.
Yeah, it's the funny part about it is it actually got remade as a television movie in the 1970s.
Yes,
seemed when I've taught 20th century world history before, and when we come to early on with World War One, I had to make a decision. I really wanted to show one of the films, and even though I wished I had had the guts, so to speak, to go back and show the 1930 version, I ended up showing the television version, which unfortunately, obviously, as we know, is not anything like the first one. But it's still much of the ideas that came through quite well, even with that one. But yeah, the nice thing about the 1930 version is that it's still available in good condition, as we know with films, especially old films, little by little, a lot of those early ones are tough to find if they haven't been properly preserved. So thankfully, All Quiet on the Western Front is still around and in good condition for people to see it.
Yeah, definitely. Great work has been done in film preservation, digitalizing old movies, but of course we've lost quite a few early films. We've not recovered them. They've deteriorated or disappeared altogether. Fortunately, All Quiet on the Western Front, I didn't delve into the theatrical release history of the movie, but I imagine that film stayed in circulation for a number of years, one way or another, after its release. And partly because of that reason, it just seemed to really stick with with people, both at the time it was released and in generations to come.
Of course, Paths of Glory had a sort of was almost based on two wars, in the sense that while it took place during World War One, we clearly were being led discussing the whole. You know, the movie also tried to make more modern points dealing with the 19. It came out in 1957, so it was right in the middle of the Red Scare and issues related to a lot of the things that happened during the 50s. So in that sense, it sort of covered both wars.
Well, I suppose an imaginative person at the time of Paths of Glory's release, wanting to think and interpret it, could have seen an analogy between the possibility of all-out destruction of our leaders leading us off the cliff, leading us down the path of total destruction, because the threat of nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union at that time could have resulted in, you know, a world that would not be very familiar to us today. And it's very possible that Stanley Kubrick, a very intelligent director, may have had some of this in mind in making the film.
Well, it was also related to the fact of the whole witch hunts that were going on as well, where it was a combination of not only the fear of, as you say, the total destruction, but also the fact that people were being accused of things and people were being made examples of, and that is such an important aspect of Paths of Glory, where it was just pure happenstance of who ended up becoming the participants to be tried for the issues as part of the middle part of the film.
Right, you know, all sorts of innocent people can be swept up in a net of suspicion, and it's great when we have a Kirk Douglas character who is unafraid of standing up and confronting authorities who are abusing their power. So yes, that was very much part of it.
What's now turning to the World War II chapter? What is very interesting, and this is as opposed to the World War I, where some of the films that you included in that list in your World War II chapter, were made when the war was actually still going on. Casablanca and Saboteur, and literally Best Years of Our Lives, was right after the war ended. It's just in many ways unusual there, the fact that there were films being made during World War II that dealt with the actual war. What were there specific characteristics for those films that you found more interesting because they were actually made while the war was going on?
Yeah, I would have been very happy to include films from 1917 and 1918, for example, for the World War One chapter, except that none of those films have really, they may survive physically in an archive somewhere, but they have not really survived in the imagination of the American public. With World War II, on the other hand, you know, there are a number of films made during the war that have transcended time. I mean, Casablanca being the great example. Saboteur is a little bit lesser known, but let me start with Casablanca, which of course is a universally acknowledged classic of filmmaking, and a happy accident that became that way because it was one of those projects where everything just seemed to click somehow. If you would have cast the movie slightly differently, if one aspect or another had just been moved around or altered, it may not have been as great a film, and we might not be talking of it today in the same way. Casablanca is not a combat film at all. I mean, there are guns are fired. I mean, I think twice in the movie, as I'm recalling right now, casualties are very light. A couple of people are killed in this movie, but there's no battle scene. The battle here in this movie has to do with human responsibility, individual responsibility in the time of a great conflict. What decisions do we make? What sacrifices are we willing to make if the cause around us is important enough, if the cause that we identify with is a good cause? Are we willing to give something up? What decisions can we make to help that cause? And the fact that there's, you know, great chemistry in the movie between the cast, It's also a marvelous love story. All these things came together to make it a remarkable film and a movie that reflects upon the cost and the decisions of people during wartime, whether they are fighting in a physical sense or not. Saboteur was interesting to me as a look at the anxiety on the American war front, particularly in the early years of U.S. involvement in the war. This movie was made in the first months after Pearl Harbor. It was made during a time when Japanese Americans began to be rounded up in the detention camps for fear that there may be fifth columnists or saboteurs among them. The movie doesn't look at the Japanese American population, but it looks at something else that was also of concern, because there really were fascist sympathizers in the U.S. Before the war and at this time. There were some sedition trials during World War II. In fact, right here in Milwaukee, where I am right now, there was the great center for the German-American Bund, a ethnic German-based Nazi organization. So people of this kind were in America at that point. Their loyalty could be questioned, and there was the concern that groups of this sort might try to undermine the war effort at home. So that movie, I think, in a very Alfred Hitchcock kind of, dramatization, I think brings to life the fears that many Americans had about the war front. And, maybe because it's an Alfred Hitchcock movie, it's a film that I think certainly film buffs widely admire. As I talk to people about my book, I'm surprised at how many people share my enthusiasm for Saboteur as being one of our favorite Alfred Hitchcock films.
Yeah, it's interesting. Alfred Hitchcock, many of his films from the 50s and early 60s are the ones these days he's probably most known for. But Saboteur is definitely one of those earlier ones, although not that early, because he was making movies even earlier than that. But that's still, I think you're right, is still very well known and very revered, for lack of any other word to use.
Yes, one of the good things about the movie, too, was that, as some Alfred Hitchcock biographers have pointed out, it has kind of a mediocre cast in a way. Robert Cummings is not Cary Grant or not Jimmy Stewart, one of the great actors that Hitchcock would later work with, but there's something about him that was so everyman American at that time. And Priscilla Lane, the female protagonist of the movie, I think was very much standing in for an ordinary American woman of the era. And the casting of it, even though, again, these are not, people we think of as A-list Hollywood stars of that era, I think the ordinariness of their performances in some way brings to life the era quite well, better maybe than if you would have had an all-star cast.
Well, of course, Hitchcock was always particularly interested in showing people in unusual, so-called normal people or everyday people in unusual, getting caught up in unusual situations. So I guess it's not a big surprise that even the casting might have worked the same way.
Well, definitely.
And then The Best Years of Our Lives was interesting in that it was probably, one of the first post-war films that immediately had to deal with this whole issue of what happened to people after the war was over. So in that sense, it's similar to, we've seen films like that even more recently with some of the more recent conflicts. But as I say, as a World War II era film, it really had an interesting way, and it also, though, was very popular.
Well, it without being didactic or heavy-handed, it brought together veterans with different experiences, different economic and social classes. All returnees, they didn't know each other, but they all came from the same hometown somewhere in the heartland of America. They encountered one another on the return journey back, and the movie, quite a long movie for that era, explored their experiences in some depth. It's also interesting because of Harold Russell, the returning sailor, who played the returning sailor in the movie, who lost his hands during a Japanese attack on his aircraft carrier. Seeing a real, handicapped veteran, returning veteran, portraying a role like that was highly unusual at that time. And it spoke to the fact that people had the awareness that many people returned home and lost a great deal physically and maybe emotionally from their service during the war. There were a lot of returning veterans in movies made in the late 1940s. Many films noir had, some indication of the psychological damage that some people may have experienced during the war. Best Years of Our Lives, though, I think, of all of these films, did the best job of putting the issue at the center of the film and of creating characters that we can still very much sympathize with and relate to all these years later.
And then, of course, what I've probably the most interesting in the sense of what Clint Eastwood did were the two of Iwo Jima films, Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. Can you talk a little bit about what was unusual? I mean, I'm reasonably sure most people know what the stories were for those two films, but could you give us some background of what Eastwood tried to do with these two films?
Well, they are kind of joined together because they refer to the same battle, the Battle of Iwo Jima. Letters from Iwo Jima, I don't know if this is entirely unique, but it was certainly unusual for a director to do a sympathetic film about one's wartime enemy, where you're not simply depicting the enemy as the enemy, much less demonizing the enemy or stereotyping the enemy, but you are actually putting the audience in the position of the side to which our country fought, bringing out the humanity, the various problems, getting beyond all of the stereotypes, which many movies about World War II made during World War II erred greatly on the side of stereotyping America's enemies, and you can look back now and understand that there were many reasons for this. I mean, many of those movies were very much intended to boost morale on the home front, to build the fighting spirit. There wasn't room in a life or death struggle, perhaps, to be nuanced about the people we were fighting with, but certainly all these years later, there is room for this, and Clint Eastwood did a great job with that, with Letters from Iwo Jima. Flags of Our Fathers, refers to the way in which the news media, with the cooperation of the authorities, can distort the depiction of history in the making. The way that heroism can become a media circus, and the toll that may take on ordinary soldiers doing their job who suddenly are thrust into this unwanted celebrity status. It really, of course, has to do with the famous raising of the American flag by a small team of Marines on a hill on Iwo Jima.
Right. Of course, then we now get to the Cold War, which, unlike the first two chapters, was much of the films that you included in this chapter are not necessarily about specific conflicts, because the Cold War wasn't a conflict. Granted, it included the Korean War and Vietnam, as you rightly include in the book, but it was just a different type of war, as the name implies. So how did you work to try to decide which films you felt, or the two of you felt, best described or best represented the Cold War?
Well, we included Manchurian Candidate, which touches on Korea at the beginning of the war, but mostly it has to do with issues on the American home front during the Cold War. Later on, there's a character who's a stand-in for Senator McCarthy. There is the question, again, of the psychological damage that may be experienced by veterans of war. There was a great deal of discussion in the American news media and among the American public about brainwashing, the idea that many American prisoners of war were subjected to forms of mental psychological manipulation by their Korean or Chinese captors during the Korean War. And, of course, this coincided with a period in which agencies of the U.S. government, particularly the CIA, were experimenting with the use of drugs such as LSD to see whether they might be useful in times of war as a way of extracting information from prisoners or for other purposes. So the movie did I think, a marvelous job of dramatizing this with it was probably, you know, the movie came out in 1962 after, you know, really the worst of the McCarthy era it was several years behind us at that point, so there was enough distance that Hollywood could feel comfortable essentially satirizing the abuses of the McCarthy era while at the same time poking fun at the communist adversaries of the U.S. during the Cold War. Frank Sinatra played a great role in this film at the height of his career in movies. So I think it's a great film, and far better than the remake that came out about 10 years ago, which most people have forgotten about. But then we also, then there was the war that fortunately never happened, and the nuclear conflict between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. I represented them with two movies, Dr. Strangelove, which was a very dark satire of the mentality that could lead to a nuclear engagement between the two countries, and Failsafe, which is a much more sober look at the possibility of a mishap causing nuclear war between the two nations. Very different movies about the same subject.
Right. One's comedic and the other one's serious, but they both cover the exact same subject. And it's interesting that Dr. Strangelove, of all the films that you did in the book, it's the one that's probably the closest to a true comedy. And yet, it's, at the time it came out, I'm sure there were probably still many people who didn't find it particularly as funny as probably nowadays. I think today, most of the films, if not all the films on your list, hold up well, but Dr. Strangelove definitely still holds up well, and it was great to see that film. It's great to watch that film over and over again as time, when you have time, it's just worth it to watch it regularly.
Well, and easier to laugh with the movie now than in 1964. I think it may have taken a little bit of courage the first time this film appeared in movie theaters. Because this was only, after all, you know, very soon after the Cuban Missile Crisis. So people sometimes toss around, you know, daring filmmaking, courageous act by Hollywood. Well, you know, Dr. Strangelove was truly a courageous film, both by the director, Stanley Kubrick, and by the film industry for releasing it at that time. And interestingly, I think that if you ask most people today about Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove, Dr. Strangelove has really very much eclipsed Failsafe to a large degree. I wanted to include Failsafe, kind of bracketing it alongside of Dr. Strangelove because of the comparison and contrasting aspects of these two movies. Both of them very fine films, looking at the possible disaster of a nuclear Armageddon in very different ways. And the satirical way of looking at it is the one that has survived best in the popular imagination.
Yet Dr. Failsafe still shows up on television on the cable channels occasionally. And
it does, and George Clooney had a made-for-TV remake of it back in the year 2000, which was actually, you know, not too bad.
Right. He took it a different way, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it definitely was worth, and it's definitely worth seeking out as well. But yeah, Failsafe, especially when it gets closer and closer to the end, and you just keep thinking, where is it going? It's just, so it definitely still holds up in many ways, even though it's not something that we regularly think about today as far as a possibility.
So right. I also included from Russia with Love.
Yeah, that was the next thing I was going to ask about, was your decision to include a James Bond film, and probably the most Cold War-ish of all the James Bond films.
Yes, I mean the early James Bond films, the previous James Bond film, Dr. No, the first one, does not mention the Cold War or communism. The malevolent character in the movie is oriental, and one could suggest that Dr. No stood in for mainland China at that time, and if you wanted to go there. But somehow, the James Bond movies, the earliest ones, were part of the culture of the Cold War. John F. Kennedy was on record as being a great fan of the Ian Fleming novels, for example. I mean, there was a great deal of attention being paid to these movies in that way at the time of their release. And what I found fascinating in doing the research for this book was Ian Fleming's service in British intelligence during World War II, and the way in which, many of the things that he saw and encountered in that service found their way into his fiction, which then in turn found their way into at least the earliest James Bond films before they went way over the top with invisible motor cars and some of the things that we remember from more recent decades.
Right. And what's interesting is that the one difference made from the book is really the Russians. Because it was made before Ian Fleming invented Spectre. But in the movie, they updated it because he had to include, to somewhat take it away from the exact Russian theme, but there's still Russian, it's still important. And in the whole issue of spies and the importance of how you need to, how the Cold War and the British and all the different European countries were important as far as the Cold War as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as spy novelists go, John le Carré is a much greater literary figure than Ian Fleming. And, many John le Carré novels have been turned into movies over the years too, but certainly the James Bond franchise is enormous, its roots are in the Cold War, so I think that many people may forget about that, where this all came from. And yes, in their way, these movies were maybe in a kind of funhouse way, perhaps, but in a way, they were reflecting the atmosphere of espionage, the moral twilight that espionage can lead to. And I included it in part, because I wanted to have a little bit fun with the book. Putting James Bond in there seemed to add a slightly lighter touch to it. But yes, I think that even the early James Bond movies do have something to tell us about public attitudes during that time.
And then, of course, Apocalypse Now. And what is interesting in many ways is that, first off, Vietnam as a subject post-war didn't appear right away, and Apocalypse Now was probably the most bombastic of all the Vietnam movies that came out. It also has probably the most tormented history of all many of the films on your list as to what Coppola went through just to make it in the first place, and all the troubles there between changing casts at the very beginning and having to deal with illnesses and issues in the Philippines during the filming. It was definitely a film that often gets compared to a war all by itself.
Well, logistically, making that movie was not unlike an amphibious invasion of an enemy-held territory. It was made under great duress. There was actually a documentary footage shot during the making of the movie that came out during the late 1980s, I believe, showing some of the problems that Coppola and his cast and crew faced in the making of the movie. But of course, one of the things too is the idea of making this sort of movie in the first place at that time, because there was a reluctance in the immediate aftermath of the end of American involvement in Vietnam for Hollywood to venture into that topic. There was one, if you want to call it, significant Vietnam War movie made during the war, the Green Berets, the John Wayne film, which, drew a great deal of flack for being a pro-war movie, being released at a time when public sentiment against the war was growing. As a film, Green Berets was very much in out of the same mold as many of the John Wayne World War II movies. It's not, whatever one's opinion about the war, it's not a great film, not a lasting accomplishment in cinema. With the end of the war, I think there was this period of almost traumatic shock on the part of the American public. I mean, disbelief. This war had done a great deal of damage, it seemed, here, at home, by dividing the country the way that it did. Casualties were relatively high. There were the problems and difficulties of the returning veterans of that war. It was a loss of faith to America on one level that this war ended the way it did. And so how do you make popular entertainment, which is the business Hollywood is in after all, out of something like that? So there was a reluctance to do this, to engage Vietnam as a subject matter. And Coppola was able to overcome that. He was a rising young talent at that point, and he had grand ideas about the possibilities of cinema as an art form as well as a form of entertainment. And he made a movie that, several years ago, there was a longer version of it released, both theatrically and then on DVD and Blu-ray, I'm sure by now, too. Which makes Apocalypse Now even longer than the original release. And I don't think that the additional material in any way benefits the film. I prefer watching the original version of it, which, tells the story of the madness of the war is what it is very good at depicting. The questionable assumptions on the part of, some military leaders, the difficulty of fighting a war in a very alien environment, fighting with or against people that Americans did not fully understand in many cases. So the sense of unease in the midst of a very alien environment, I think, is what Apocalypse Now does best.
Yeah, it's interesting. Most of the most interesting extra scenes that were added in all deal with, or there's a long scene dealing with a bunch of French people who obviously had been living there since the French first were part of when Vietnam was a colony. And that's probably the major extra scene that got included in the additional part. But it does sort of completely change the tone of the film when that scene occurs.
Yes, and I wonder why it was there. I mean, I remember reading somewhere the theory that this is basically a ghost scene that these people were dead already, the swift boat wandered into a metaphysical realm there, perhaps. What was that? What was Coppola thinking of? By wanting to include this in the film, there was quite a bit of conflict, between the screenwriter Milius and Coppola, who had very different ideas, it seems, about not only the movie but about the war itself. And Milius tends to be more pro-war in his attitudes, and Coppola not so. And I think that what you end up with, which perhaps makes it a great film, is that it's difficult to say that Apocalypse Now takes sides precisely. I mean, you can get lost in endless interpretations of what this movie is trying to tell us. I mean, it doesn't make its point easily and plainly, and maybe because of that, it has survived the way it has, not just because of several spectacular scenes, but because the movie seems to give us something to think about without necessarily telling us what to think about it.
And memory serves, I think Milius was involved in Red Dawn.
Right. Yeah, a very different kind of a war film.
Right, and late Cold War. So then that brings us to the most current period in the book, the War on Terror. Probably, in some ways, the most frightening films, because for those of us who are, you know, we're living through the era, maybe in a way that some of the earlier films would have been like for the people who were, you know, around when those films came out. But the three films you mentioned, United 93, The Hurt Locker, and Zero Dark 30, they're definitely much different from what we're used to seeing with war films. They seem raw and even more frightening because of that. In fact, United 93, I've seen it once, and I don't know that I ever want to see it again.
Well, yes, what United 93 does very well is to remind us of the morning of September 11th, 2001, because nobody understood or knew what was going on at that point. There was a great deal of confusion, and the movie captures that confusion, the confusion in air traffic control, certainly the confusion aboard the doomed airliner. And, you know, I mean, I remember seeing the second tower go down live on TV, and it was just, you know, an incredible sense of chaos in the air, and United 93 gets that. But also, there are no, you know, stars in this movie, and I think the movie benefits from that as well, because it's to say if Tom Hanks had been one of the cast members and he was among the passengers in the cabin of Flight 93, we as an audience would have fixated on him. We would have seen, okay, he's the guy who's going to be leading the charge at the cockpit, okay. And we didn't have that as an audience to latch onto. Again, we were looking at a bunch of people who looked very much like ordinary middle-class Americans on a plane ride. I mean, I think that it's, the ability for us to relate to the people on screen was enhanced by this. United 93 and the other two movies were the result in some way of trends in filmmaking that allowed for a greater mobility, the ability to shoot quickly and on the fly, and to, you know, the greater willingness of the public, or certain segments of the public anyway, to suspend the star system a little bit more, to look at darker topics done without, much pretense to the glossiness of old Hollywood. Hurt Locker is a film about set during the American occupation of Iraq. It focuses on a small squad of men who are disposing of IEDs. The movie never refers to politics, to strategy, even to the reasons these soldiers are there is not even alluded to. They are simply there. You know, the movie puts us in their boots, I think, very well. It puts us in a situation where, you know, these soldiers are, you know, in a life or death struggle to survive. They don't know where the shots are going to come from. They don't know if some object, innocuous thing laying along the side of the road, is going to blow up. And if they suspect it is, it's going to be a very tricky, dangerous thing to disarm that weapon. Zero Dark Thirty is a little bit different, even though it's by the same director as Hurt Locker, Catherine Bigelow, because there the movie got into some controversial territory, which is very timely at the moment.
It still keeps being brought up, right?
Yeah, the Senate report on enhanced interrogation. Zero Dark Thirty is all about enhanced interrogation or torture. And it seems to take the position that useful information was gleaned from the use of torture, and that, in fact, as I understood the movie when it was released, that the decision by President Obama to pull back from some of these techniques may even have slowed the hunt for Osama bin Laden. And this, the thesis of the film, generated something of a firestorm from all ends at the time of its release, and the topic certainly has not gone away at all. I mean, right now we're hearing yet another, you know, wave of debate and controversy over the morality of using techniques of this kind, whether you want to call them torture or something else. And the usefulness, you know, the utilitarian value, if any, of this. And there are highly placed people, you know, on both sides of the debate who have completely opposite points of view on this.
And it's interesting, as you said, Hurt Locker in particular, you don't have to worry. I mean, just like some of the other films, we don't get into why the war is going on. It's just the story of what's going on during the war, and sometimes that's the best way to handle the issue. And the fact that you may or agree or disagree with why of the war doesn't change the fact of what's actually happening and or what happened and the issues faced by people like some of the characters.
Right. Well, one interesting thing, publisher of the book, Potomac Books, University of Nebraska Press, suggested that for the War on Terror chapter, we have dates, you know, to correspond with every conflict chapter in the book, and we have I had 2001 through ? And they said, well, it, you know, this was, I think, two years ago. Why don't we end it now? President Obama made a speech recently saying the war on terror is over, but you know, shortly after that, we experienced the Boston Marathon bombings. We now today have a resurgence of Islamic fundamentalist terrorism going on. We have ISIS. And I'm very glad that I held my ground and said no, keep the question mark there, because we don't really know at this point when the war on terror is really over. I mean, certainly perhaps a phase of the war on terror had ended by the time the manuscript of the book was being completed, but I think we would all agree that the war on terror is going on right now as we speak.
To say nothing of the fact is that part of it is the fact that it depends on how you define the war on terror. There can be terror, as we know, from other phases. It's not just going to be the most obvious ones that came out of September 11th, but there's other terrorist activities that still go on that have nothing to do with those topics and will continue to go on. So, unfortunately, the war on terror is something I think we will live with probably forever in some way, shape, or form. It's just a matter sometimes of who are the perpetrators, but it's still something that has been going on for a long, long time. We don't even have to talk about just as long current period.
Right. I mean, I always felt that coining the term war on terror was a misnomer, because, I mean, there could be many wars on terror, because terrorism doesn't come in one flavor or as one brand, as I think you're pointing out. But, you know, Ireland, Northern Ireland during the 1970s and 80s, you know, the terrorism was prevalent there. Sri Lanka, you know, went through a period of 10, 20 years of a terrorist led civil war. I mean, there is terrorism going on in many parts of the world under the auspices of one cause or another, And the United States happens to be focused on one particular sort of terrorism because of 9/11. But, you know, to use the term war on terror, I mean, it's a very encompassing phrase. And, you know, I think it's much too broadly.
Mm-hmm. What other films that you didn't get a chance to include? Are there any films that maybe were just below the cut that you thought are worth mentioning as being particularly good examples of war films?
Well, yeah, I mean, because we put the Cold War chapter together the way we did, if we would have had a Vietnam War chapter, which was the idea I had at the beginning of the project, we would have gotten into a few other movies like Full Metal Jacket, for example. Well, that would have been the third Stanley Kubrick right. films in one book, which might be, you know, I mean, of course, he was a great director, so I could defend that. But yes, I would have included that under Vietnam. I might have thought about Deer Hunter for another Vietnam movie. There certainly World War II was probably the great movie for, you know, inspiring, the great war rather for inspiring movies. I have not done an exact tabulation, but I am willing to make an educated guess that there are more movies about World War II than about any other single war in human history.
No, I'm sure that's true.
Yeah, and there certainly are some other fine examples of World War II movies that we could have gotten into. One of the very curious things in thinking about the Cold War period was the Korean War. There are, you know, a handful of very good Korean War movies that I enjoy seeing, but none of them really ever captivated the public imagination in a big way. The biggest movie about the Korean War, which is Tokori, is a movie that I watched with the idea of possibly including it, but I frankly thought it was a terrible movie and very kind of schlocky in many respects. It had some good footage from shot from an aircraft carrier showing the comings and goings of combat planes. That was good, but the storyline and the grafting of a conventional Hollywood love story onto this. I mean, I don't think that movie has survived the test of time very well. And I don't think it really fired up the imagination of moviegoers at the time it was released either. So what I'm getting to here is that we have spoken quite a bit in recent years of Korea as the forgotten war. And more efforts are being made in recent years to try to remember the surviving veterans of that war who, you know, did not get acknowledged in the same way that returning World War II veterans were, and so on. And I think that perhaps there are a number of reasons why the Korean War became the forgotten war, but one of them might be that there was never a great Korean War movie that really captured the imagination and the memory of the public.
Now, the only one I can think of when I was looking at the chapter, that obviously you didn't really have a film that was the Korean War other than the aspects of Manchurian Candidate. The only one I could come up with was MASH, and as a straightforward comedy, that movie, but it did take place during the Korean War, but it had a different reasoning behind why it was being made.
Yeah, I think that Robert Altman was using Korea as a stand-in for Vietnam. I would argue that at that point that really though MASH was set ostensibly in the Korean War, it was really, you know, spoofing the Vietnam conflict, and I think that many people in the audience at that time saw it that way. So I thought about MASH actually. I'm glad you brought that up. We kind of kicked that one around a little bit, but. That got left on the cutting room floor because, well, you know, was it really a Korean War movie after all anyway, even though that's when it was supposed to be taking place?
Yeah, right. And same people said the same thing about the television show, although the television show lasted well past the end of the war. But yeah, the movie definitely, because it came out right in the middle when protesting started to really take on even more.
Yes, well, and at that time, too, when Hollywood probably would have been loath to do a Vietnam War movie. So, well, no, this isn't a Vietnam War movie. It's a Korean War movie. Okay, but I think that many people understood it as being a satire in some way of Vietnam.
So what are your plans going forward? What are you working on now, or have you come up with something new to be writing about?
Well, I'm under deadline right now. I have to complete it by the end of the year, a book called Secret Societies in American History. I am really a few pages, literally, from completing the manuscript of that. That's a book that looks at a variety of secretive covert organizations, everything from the Mafia to the Ku Klux Klan to the Triads to Heaven's Gate, and some of them, you know, more obviously religious cults, some of them more criminal or political in their orientation, but the link between all of them is that they were operating you know, below the surface. They kept secrets. The membership role was secret, or the practices were secret in some ways. And it's a look at what impact, if any, you know, these groups had on the country we live in. And what I found is that many of them, you know, did have a significant influence on the course of events.
Frankly, the History Channel on cable makes the most out of those secret societies. So
they do, but there are a lot of really bad,
right.
erroneous. I mean, one of the challenges of writing that kind of book was to sift through, false claims, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, historians who, because of all the false claims, want to pretend that these organizations even never existed at all, or that they really, you know, were utterly insignificant. And in many cases, the truth is somewhere in the middle, of course.
Right. So you're the anti-Dan Brown in this book.
Definitely, yes.
Well, I really appreciated talking to you about this. As I say, it was a nice way of looking at the topic. I mean, obviously, we've seen books on war films before, but you took a good way of reaching, of picking out the films you did. And like I say, it's an incredibly great selection of films. And I think not only is it worth reading about them, but every one of them should be worth watching again. And the good thing is, in these days of home video and other methods, that every one of them, as far as I can tell from looking at it, I'm sure are all available for people to watch again. So,
yes, they're all very accessible.
Right, which is another good reason to include them on your list. Accessible films means people are more likely to study them. But as I say, this was an enjoyable conversation, and like I say, I hope you continue to have success with your books, and better get your deadline. We've only got 2 weeks left to go in the year.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You have a good day. Thanks a lot.
You too.
I hope you found my conversation with David Lurson interesting, and that you seek out the book War on the Silver Screen, Shaping America's Perception of History. In addition, all the films David and Glenn included in their book are readily available from a number of video sources. They are all worth looking for. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more new books in film.